Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Owen O'Connor, and to begin, we chatted about the management of T-cell lymphomas. And to introduce the subject, Dr. O'Connor presented a 56-year-old patient with peripheral T-cell lymphoma from his practice.
So he was actually pretty healthy with a pretty good performance status, and he had to travel a fair distance to get to us. So he came for a second opinion. He got standard CHOP-based chemotherapy, and like many of these patients, he had about 4 cycles, and at his interim restaging study, he actually had progression of disease. So again, a lot of these patients with T-cell lymphoma do have substantial acquired drug resistance. Now, this patient was recommended to get ICE-based chemotherapy and then get considered for going on to an autologous stem cell transplant. So when we looked at his disease, we actually found that he was CD30 positive. So interestingly, about 25 to 30% of patients with peripheral T-cell lymphoma will be CD30 positive. As many people recognize, patients with anaplastic large cell lymphoma, virtually all of them will be CD30 positive, and that's where the indication, of course, for brentuximab sits. But he was CD30 positive. So in this case, we actually had a clinical trial that was looking at the role of brentuximab in peripheral T-cell lymphoma, actually looking in all CD30 positive lymphoproliferative malignancies, irrespective of the histopathologic subtype.
So, you know, the theme of reliability of marked predictors of response is one that goes throughout oncology. And it was only recently that I started to hear people talking about whether or not CD30 is that straightforward, and whether or not maybe responses might be seen to an agent like B-Vedotin in patients who might be called or labeled CD30 negative. Is that true?
Yeah, there's been some discussion about responses, and I think Dr. Zanzani from Bologna has presented some data in patients where there was a question of CD30 negativity in some patients being treated with brentuximab and having responses, which has raised all sorts of other questions about that potential mechanism of action. I think at this point, I haven't heard a whole lot more about it other than that particular scenario, but it is one of the reasons why the FDA has mandated a companion diagnostic that will be developed with the registration, the post-marketing commitment studies for brentuximab in Hodgkin lymphoma as well as in anaplastic large cell lymphoma. So they are actually mandating a companion diagnostic that will drill down quantitatively to look at the relative amounts of CD30 expression on the surface of individual cells as well as the spectrum of cells that are positive and to what extent that they are positive. It's interesting that if you look at most of the data that's been presented to date, sort of the interpretation has been that the amount of CD30 has not been a predictor of response to the drug. And I think that's important. Now, how do you go and explain, well, there are some cases where there are CD30 negative T-cell lymphoma patients that are potentially responding. I think you have to understand that many of these cells sit in a complex milieu, a complex stromal microenvironment, and there may be influences from other activated T-cells that are not necessarily the malignant ones that may be contributing to the survival of the lymphoma in that microenvironment that could be also adversely affected by the brentuximab. But I think for the moment, the dogma that the amount of CD30 expression on the T cells has not been a predictor of response to brentuximab is kind of where the current sentiment sits.
So obviously the issue of brentuximab-vedotin is out on the table for this patient. What are the other options, though, out there, for example, maybe if he had been CD30 negative that you might consider in this situation?
Sure. And that's another good question. And in our practice, we tend to use some of those single agent drugs that have been approved by the FDA for patients with relapsed or refractory disease, including pralatrexate and including romidepsin, for example. So the other drug to think about in this setting would be a gemcitabine-based treatment. And gemcitabine, we know, is pretty active in patients with peripheral T-cell lymphoma, but it's worth reminding everybody that there's only a very, very small number of patients with relapsed or refractory T-cell lymphoma that have ever been treated with gemcitabine. cytobine. So that experience, while we may all have a little bit that's positive, the published literature with gemcitabine and peripheral T-cell lymphoma is actually minuscule. So again, depending upon the patient, depending upon where you think the aggressiveness of their disease is, we would consider drugs like pralatrexate, we would consider drugs like romidepsin and or a gemcitabine-based treatment for patients like this. When you think about gemcitabine, you can think about it alone or in combination with navalbine or Doxil or oxaliplatin. I think that when it comes to patients with relapsed or refractory T-cell lymphoma, we're still embracing this notion that we need to manage these patients precisely the same way that we manage patients with B-cell lymphoma. And I'm not absolutely convinced. We all believe that once they relapse, we have to continue using combination intense chemotherapy regimens to get control of their disease. And that might mean ICE, it might mean GND, it might mean DHAP, it might mean other intense combination regimens. But for me, when you look at the data with romidepsin and pralatrexate and the hundreds of patients that have been treated, these single agent drugs are able to achieve pretty substantial remissions in a lot of these patients. And if you look at the duration of the remission from these single agent drugs, they're in the order of a year. And a lot of the data that's been retrospectively looked at from PROPEL and retrospectively looked at from romidepsin suggests, just as you might expect, that the earlier you use those drugs, the better patients will do. So when you look at the PROPEL data set where patients had a median of 3 prior lines of therapy, if you look at patients getting it in their first relapse, the response rate is closer to 45% compared to the 29% seen in the entire population. And that fits with what we understand about almost every cancer and its management with chemotherapy. Use these new drugs earlier in the natural history of the disease. And I think because these diseases do generally so poorly with combination therapy that I tend to think about some of those drugs earlier. And if I get them into a complete remission, I then think about consolidating them with an autologous stem cell transplant, or depending upon the disease and the patient, we'll even have a discussion about the role of allogeneic stem cell transplant.
And of course, you were the PI on the PROPEL trial that looked at pralatrexate and PTCL. How do you decide which to start first, romidepsin or pralatrexate?
Yeah, it's a very commonly asked question. And everybody may have their own formula for how they think about it. But the way I think about it is that pralatrexate, at least in my experience, works a little bit faster than romidepsin. So if I have a sense that a patient has a lot of disease-related symptoms and we need to get control of the disease and that they're not malnourished in obvious ways, I will probably look to a drug like pralatrexate first. For patients in whom I think that, you know, they have small volume disease, they're doing pretty good, and we have a little bit of time to try to give the romidepsin a chance to work, the romidepsin probably needs a couple of cycles before you can get enough in to see a benefit, then I might try a drug like romidepsin. A lot of people worry about, you know, what drug should come first. I think you have to tailor, just like you do any chemotherapy drug, you have to try to tailor the drug and what you feel about the drug's activity in a particular situation to that particular patient's scenario.
Can you talk a little bit more about your clinical experiences with these two drugs and what the key tolerability issues are?
So with pralatrexate, the big issue is mucositis, and there's been a lot of work done since the publication of the PROPEL data set, and there's been, I would say, a couple of simple changes that seem to be, at least in my hand, made the mucositis a whole lot less important. And I think the first thing to remember is, if you look at the pralatrexate data set, the incidence of grade 3-4 mucositis is somewhere in the order of 17%. And one of the problems with mucositis is any patient who has sort of suffered grade 2 mucositis represents severe enough mucositis that it impacts their life. But when you design these trials, they're designed to find 30% risk of grade 3-4 toxicity. The problem is that grade 2 mucositis is still very uncomfortable for most patients. Many of the new schedules with pralatrexate are looking at giving it 3 weeks out of 4, And there's been some nice work, I think, from Mark Kaminsky up in Michigan, where he's actually looked at giving intervening leucovorin to some of those patients that have developed mucositis. And in some cases, he does it preemptively, and others have sort of adopted this. There's been a couple of abstracts presented at ASH and ASCO that have looked at this. And in our own practice, if a patient develops, you know, even early grade mucositis, we might come in early with some leucovorin between the intervening doses of pralatrexate, which seems to have had a big impact on lowering that incidence of mucositis. I think the other big thing that we have done, and I know colleagues of mine who have asked me about it have also done it, is rather than starting at 30, which is the FDA label, we know from that early experience that there are only two major determinants of mucositis. One is your pretreatment methylmalonic acid level. If that number is very high, you have a high risk of developing mucositis, and that's why you need the vitamin B12 and folic acid. But the other is the idiosyncratic area under the curve of drug exposure. So we know that patients who have higher AUCs of pralatrexate exposure are also at higher risk of mucositis. So what we typically do is we start in week one at 10 milligrams per meter squared. If that's tolerated, we go to 20. And if that's tolerated, we'll go to 30. If the patient develops any early grade mucositis, grade 1 or grade 2, we'll actually stop at that dose. So if we get to 20 milligrams per meter squared, we'll just keep on at 20 milligrams per meter squared with the folate and the B12 and use some intervening leucovorin if it's necessary. So there are changes that are coming, and in fact, the sponsor of the drug now is looking at trying to do studies where they look at planned intermittent dosing with leucovorin analogs between the doses of pralatrexate as one strategy to cut back on the mucositis. So I would say that's the big issue. The secondary issues revolve around thrombocytopenia, but those are typically managed with dose reductions, schedule delays, or transfusions.
And how about romidepsin?
Romidepsin, in my experience, is a very well-tolerated drug, but like a lot of the histone deacetylase inhibitors, it has many of the side effects of the class. So that can include fatigue, can include a little bit of low energy, a little bit of anorexia, and also some thrombocytopenia. Again, the thrombocytopenia can be managed with dose reductions, schedule delays, or transfusions as needed, but I typically find romidepsin to be a very, very well-tolerated drug. And again, if I have a patient who's a little bit older and I don't think is going to be able to tolerate the potential risk of mucositis, I might think about using romidepsin first in that scenario. It is a drug that when you get a remission, those remissions tend to be very, very durable, and the patient tends to tolerate the drug for a long time. So I've had patients on romidepsin for well over a year. And I'll note, I've also had patients on pralatrexate for well over a year, and I have had a handful of patients on each of those treatments who got about a year of therapy who had many years of a duration of response with relapsed or refractory disease. So I tend to argue that many of these single agent drugs, if we learn how to use them better and we use them earlier in the natural history of the disease, that we can get very good disease control with a meaningful quality of life with the treatment program.
What about vorinostat?
So vorinostat is an old favorite of ours going back to our days at Memorial working with Dr. Marks and Rifkin and Kevin Kelly. And vorinostat, as you know, got approved for the treatment of relapsed or refractory cutaneous T-cell lymphoma based on the work of Madeline Duvack and Liz Olson. But vorinostat is going off patent in the next couple of years. And aside from its approval in relapsed or refractory cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, it never really branched out into other particular disease states. I see the usage of vorinostat probably declining over the next few years, especially as more experience with romidepsin emerges and possibly other HDAC inhibitors like belinostat.
I am curious what happened to this man. I'm hoping you're going to tell me he went on bevacizumab and has had a great response and then got transplanted.
So in this particular case, he did go on to brentuximab, and we then consolidated his complete remission with an autologous stem cell transplant, a beam-based transplant, and he has done very well. Now, one of the questions that does come up in patients like him is related to the use of brentuximab vedotin after the transplant. And as you know, the Athera study, which is one of the post-marketing commitment studies that the sponsor has proposed to the FDA in patients with Hodgkin's disease, looked at trying to institute brentuximab, I think about 60 to 70 days after the autologous stem cell transplant in patients with relatively high-risk Hodgkin lymphoma. We hope to have that data. I think there's a hope that we might have some insights into the efficacy of this randomized trial where patients were randomized to receive B-vedotin post-transplant versus those that didn't. We hope to have some insights into the efficacy data later this year. But that's another question that comes up, and I actually think it's a good question. I haven't yet put myself in a position where I do it because it's not on label and we don't have data in this particular population. But you might think that Athera-style approach to using a drug like brentuximab vedotin post-transplant in patients who are CD30-positive peripheral T-cell lymphoma would be a good strategy, because in a disease where you don't want to relapse, it's surely going to be a challenging circumstance. Trying to treat minimal residual disease post-autologous stem cell transplant in a fashion like this could represent a pretty significant therapeutic advance. It would require, you know, a pretty large randomized study to prove that, and I think people are going to wait to see how the Athera study pans out. But I think that strategy of using antibody drug conjugates post definitive therapy or post consolidation therapy like transplant could represent a maintenance strategy or a post transplant strategy that could have a significant therapeutic benefit.
It makes total sense. When this man got the pre-transplant treatment with the B-vedotin, how many cycles did he get, and what was the timing of the response?
So that's another really good question, because the issue is always, how much do you continue? And if you look at the label, at least in anaplastic large cell lymphoma and in Hodgkin's disease, the intent is to get about a year of therapy, which is 16 cycles of therapy. So the question always comes up as to, you know, what do you do in that patient with Hodgkin lymphoma or that patient with anaplastic large cell lymphoma that gets a complete remission after the sixth cycle? Do you go to 8 cycles and stop, or do you just continue for the full 16 cycles? Now, interestingly, some out there have said, well, if you get a complete remission after 6 cycles, then I'm going to call everything after that maintenance therapy. And I don't think that's how the FDA has looked at it, and I don't think that's how the sponsor has looked at it. I don't call receiving a planned 16 cycles of therapy maintenance therapy just because you had your complete response at the 4th or 6th cycle of therapy. So when I think I'm going to try to bridge the patient to a transplant, what I try to do is give them 3 to 4 cycles, try to see if we can get them into complete remission. And if we can get them in a good complete remission, I might try to give another 2 cycles of therapy, A, to confirm that the remission is durable, that they're not going to blow right out of it after I stop and try to head into the transplant. And B, I try to make sure that I can try to deepen that remission so that I take them into the transplant with the least amount of disease they have. So if I think I'm going to be bridging them to an autologous stem cell transplant, I'll take them to complete remission, try to give them a couple of cycles more, and move them in. Now, remember, this is really early in the game in terms of trying to think about how we're using drugs like brentuximab vedotin in peripheral T-cell lymphoma. There's not a big experience. There's a small trial. It's an off-label. If you were to do it off the clinical trial, it would obviously be off-label. So there's not a whole lot of experience. But what I tend to do is make a decision up front. Am I going to take them to transplant or not? And if I intend to take them to transplant, give a defined amount of therapy, look for the opportunity to intervene post-CR. And if I don't think they're a transplant candidate, I'll actually impose a little less imaging and try to get them through the full 16 cycles of therapy.
So I've been meaning to ask you, because I've noticed over the last year that you're the only one I've heard pronounce it brentuximab vedotin, and I was wondering, is that like a Bronx version of it, or
some combination of Bronx and Scarsdale? I don't know.
Anyhow, so with this man, did he have any toxicity, any neurotoxicity from the treatment, and how long did it take before you started to see a response?
So in this guy, I looked at about 4 cycles post-treatment, and that's when we saw that he was essentially in a complete remission. And yeah, many of these patients do develop problems with neuropathy, and it's something my nurses have gotten very good at keeping track of, and the nurses have taken it on to try to really monitor that neuropathy. And if there's any signs of neuropathy, it's just like any of the other classic neuropathic drugs like bortezomib, that it's best to actually not take the chance and push through it by keeping the dose. It's best to lower the dose to 1.2 and try to treat them from there. Usually the neuropathy is reversible. Sometimes you need a little bit of a scheduled delay. And a guy like this who you're taking on to the transplant, the name of the game is get him into the transplant as healthy as possible with the least comorbidities possible.
So you mentioned the idea of moving agents of single agent activity up front. I want to ask you what's going on in terms of pralatrexate and romidepsin in terms of moving them earlier up front with chemo. And also, I see you had a presentation at Lugano about the Echelon 2 trial. What's that?
So I'll take the former question first, because our IRB approved the phase 1-2 study that will look at the combination of pralatrexate plus romidepsin in a phase 1-2 study. It's based on the obvious rationale that you have two independent drugs that have been approved for patients with relapsed and refractory disease, so trying to combine them makes sense. But it's also based on some laboratory data we've generated where looking at these two drugs in combination in preclinical models of T-cell lymphoma has been able to affect complete remissions in many of these murine models, substantiating a potential synergistic interaction, which we've also seen in vitro. So that trial holds a lot of promise in the sense that it'll be the first one to really look at combining these T-cell specific or T-cell specific active drugs in a way to try to build potential new platforms that could one day challenge the upfront CHOP platform. The Echelon trial is one that's the registration-directed study of brentuximab vedotin with a CHOP-based chemotherapy, but obviously without the vincristine. So it's CHP brentuximab versus CHOP in patients with anaplastic large cell lymphoma and T-cell lymphoma, actually, CD30-positive T-cell lymphoma. So that study, I think, is a really, really important one because the addition of brentuximab, now it'll only be for those subtypes of disease that are obviously CD30 positive. So that could account for only about a third of all those patients with T-cell lymphoma. So at the moment, the accrual is starting relatively slowly as people get their arms around looking at CD30 as part of their upfront diagnostic workup for patients with these diseases. But that trial could, I think, have a really significant impact on the natural history of T-cell lymphoma. I think that if the activity is anywhere close to what we've seen in anaplastic large cell lymphoma and the early signals that we see from patients with T-cell lymphoma and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that's CD30 positive, suggests that this drug is very, very active in those particular situations. So I think it may represent one of our first big advances to that CHOP backbone by adding something new that could advance the upfront induction care of these patients. As you well know, there's a randomized study looking at pralatrexate being integrated with CHOP and romidepsin being integrated into CHOP chemotherapy. So we now have 3 international randomized studies in the upfront setting for patients with T-cell lymphoma, where the brentuximab study will be looking at only CD30 positive T-cell lymphomas. The pralatrexate and romidepsin studies will be taking all comers.
Now, in this Echelon study, what's the actual schedule? Do you stop the B-vedotin when you stop the rest of the chemo, or do you keep it going? What was the discussion about duration?
Yeah, so that was a big discussion with the FDA early on, and there was one proposal to try to continue for 16 cycles of therapy, but the FDA thought that for having a fair comparison, if you're going to give 6 or 8 cycles of CHOP chemotherapy, then it should be compared to 6 or 8 cycles of CHP brentuximab vedotin therapy administered on the same number. So there's no provision in that trial, despite some early discussion to do it, there's no provision in that trial to give an extended brentuximab vedotin regimen to those patients that get randomized to the treatment arm.
And I guess there's a similar phase 3 trial, I believe, in anaplastic large cell looking at CHP/B vedotin and CD30 positive disease.
Yeah, I think it's the same study looking at it in just the CD30s. I'm actually not sure at the moment if there's a separate one for anaplastic large cell lymphoma.
Oh, I see. Right. Let's get back to new agents in T-cell lymphoma. And I'd like you to comment on the data you presented at ASCO in an oral presentation on the so-called BELIEF trial. I always like the acronyms. BELIEF sounds kind of, you know, inspirational. And you can tell me whether you found the results inspirational.
Well, the BELIEF study looked at a new hydroxamic acid analog known as belinostat. And belinostat has been around for a while. It's probably a little bit more potent than vorinostat, but probably not nearly as potent as romidepsin in terms of those IC50 values that you might look at in vitro assays. But belinostat studied in the BELIEF study in patients with relapsed or refractory peripheral T-cell lymphoma actually reported a response rate of about 26% or so, 25% in patients with relapsed or refractory disease. And interestingly, in the initial agreement with the FDA, the primary objective was to have a response rate in excess of 20% in this patient population. So it gives you some insight into how low our expectations are for just getting some responses in this patient population. When you look at the duration of response, many of the data in BELIEF were actually very, very similar to what we've seen with the other HDAC inhibitors like romidepsin. Hard to compare it to vorinostat because there's little to no experience with vorinostat in peripheral T-cell lymphoma. But I think there were two important observations that came away from the BELIEF study, aside from the ones where it reaffirmed that HDAC inhibitors seem to have a unique class effect in T-cell lymphoma. And this is yet another example where, whether it's vorinostat or it's romidepsin or it's belinostat, and maybe even we can talk about panobinostat, for reasons that are not entirely clear, the HDAC inhibitors have a unique single-agent class effect in T-cell lymphoma that has activity somewhere in the 25 to 30% range. Now, one of the interesting observations from the BELIEF study was the response rate in angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma, where it seemed to be a whole lot higher than had been reported in the PROPEL study with pralatrexate, and it had been a whole lot higher than had been reported in the romidepsin study. So early on in PROPEL and in the early NCI experience from Susan Bates with romidepsin, the response rate in angioimmunoblastic lymphoma was reported to be about 8%, when the overall response rates in those two trials were 26 and 29%. So everybody sort of interpreted that and said, well, you know, these drugs are not as active in angioimmunoblastic lymphoma as they are in the other subtypes of peripheral T-cell lymphoma. A lot of people came behind that and said, you know, be careful. These are small studies. They're not really designed to look at the single agent response rate in a unique subtype of the disease. So you have to take all that into account. The registration-directed studies with romidepsin and peripheral T-cell lymphoma produced response rates in angioimmunoblastic lymphoma that were better than what the NCI had seen, so testifying to the fact that there can be a lot of variability even with the same drug across two different trials. But in the case of belinostat, the response rate in angioimmunoblastic lymphoma was markedly higher than had been seen even in the overall patient population. So that was taken as a signal that there may be some really interesting biology that's being targeted in angioimmunoblastic lymphoma by belinostat not being potentially targeted by the other HDAC inhibitors. I think it's a provocative finding. I think I wouldn't make too much of it at the moment. I think we need more data. These are still relatively small studies, 100 plus patients. And when you look at the individual number of patients on these studies, we're still talking about somewhere between 10 and 20 patients with these particular subtypes of T-cell lymphoma. So small numbers. I think it's provocative and it warrants more study, but I wouldn't make too much of it at the moment. It needs to be vetted.
And I guess Steve Horowitz presented the subset data out of the BELIEF study looking at angioimmunoblastic disease at Lugano. Anything that he presented, and you were part of that there, other than the fact that the response rate was so encouraging?
So, you know, the response rate in angioimmunoblastic was one of the big messages that Steve tried to emphasize. But I think the second message which was one both emphasized by Steve and ourselves at ASCO, was the fact, and I think this may be one of the more interesting aspects of the BELIEF study, was the activity in patients with very low platelet counts. And if you go back and you look at the PROPEL study, we originally had a cutoff of about 50,000 in PROPEL, but we discovered that if you had a platelet count of just over 50,000, say 60, 70,000, you still experienced significant thrombocytopenia that caused you to miss subsequent doses of the drug. So after the first 15, 20 patients, the platelet criteria was actually increased to 100,000, just like it was in romidepsin. But if you look in the BELIEF study, they had a platelet cutoff of 50,000. So most of their patients had platelets of over 100,000. Many of these patients, as you know, get beat up and have platelet counts under 100,000, so technically would not be eligible for the drug if it gets approved with a platelet count of 100,000. But they actually found that for many of the patients that had platelet counts between 50 and 100,000, they even had a few that had counts under 50,000, there was a respectable response rate in those patients. And more importantly, it was very well tolerated, irrespective of what their pretreatment platelet count was. So at least based upon the data we have so far, we always could use a little bit more, it seems like BELIEF or belinostat was reasonably well tolerated in patients who had compromised platelet counts going into the treatment and also produced some really reasonable response rates. And when you looked at the trend of how the platelets responded post-treatment in those patients that had counts under 100,000, many of those patients had a gradual increase in their platelet count with subsequent cycles of therapy, suggesting that the drug is able to take care of some of the disease in the bone marrow and allow normal hematopoiesis or megakaryopoiesis to become reinstated and help establish a better platelet count for the patient.
So it looked like in the BELIEF study, I think there were like 20-some patients who had platelet counts under 100,000 out of 120-something, so maybe, I don't know, 20% or something. Does that correlate with what you see in your practice?
It's even worse than that. I think in the practice, most of the patients we see have platelet counts under 100,000 with peripheral T-cell lymphoma. That's probably owing to the fact that when we see them for any of the clinical trials we have, they have gone through multiple lines of chemotherapy. So many of them have had CHOP and oxaliplatin or gemcitabine, possibly autologous stem cell transplants. So the patients in the clinical trial are, of course, selected. They have to sort of meet certain eligibility criteria compared to those patients that you're treating with conventional drugs off study.
One final question about T-cell lymphoma. Alisertib, MLN8237, what do we know about it and where is it right now in development?
Yeah, so alisertib is a Aurora A kinase inhibitor. And some of the initial work had been done by the group up at Rochester. John Freeberg did one of the first phase one, phase twos. And given the mode of action, which is that it worked predominantly on rapidly proliferating cells, a sort of a M phase specific type drug, they actually had the expectation the drug would have substantial activity in diseases like Burkitt's lymphoma and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. But much to their surprise, they found early on that patients with peripheral T-cell lymphoma seemed to be responding almost preferentially compared to many of the other B-cell lymphomas that they had enrolled on the study. This rapidly moved to an international randomized phase three clinical trial for patients who have relapsed or refractory peripheral T-cell lymphoma, looking at the randomization of patients to either receive alisertib or dealer's choice. And the dealer's choice includes single agent gemcitabine, romidepsin, or pralatrexate. So it's one of the first studies looking at a randomized treatment option for patients in the relapsed or refractory setting.
One more issue I wanted your thoughts about, because you've had a lot of experience with bortezomib and mantle cell lymphoma, and that relates to the recent FDA approval of lenalidomide in relapsed refractory disease. How do you go about sequencing len and bortezomib?
As somebody who's been involved in the bortezomib experience for a long time, I've seen bortezomib work remarkably well in patients with very, very chemotherapy-resistant mantle cell lymphoma. And I have seen bortezomib convert chemotherapy-resistant or refractory disease to chemotherapy-sensitive disease when you combine it with other alkylator-type drugs like cyclophosphamide or bendamustine. So I think bortezomib can help overcome some acquired and intrinsic drug resistance by integrating it even into chemotherapy regimens the patient has seen. That being said, the results that we've seen with lenalidomide, and there's been a little bit of debate about the schedule, the FDA-approved schedule, of course, is 25 milligrams for 3 weeks out of four. But we have seen patients with mantle cell lymphoma who have had disease that has been managed for, you know, years. And seeing disease in elderly patients who are really not suitable for combination chemotherapy, watching lenalidomide, and we admittedly will add some rituximab, we've seen patients get to complete remission and sustain those remissions for long periods of time. So my bias has been that we will probably try lenalidomide in most patients up front, as long as we don't see an urgent need for some rapid cytoreduction. We'll probably start with lenalidomide, adding rituximab to the program. We will modulate the dose a little bit. We've actually found that in many of these older patients, they tend not to tolerate that 25 milligrams for 3 weeks on and a week off because of blood count problems. So we will sometimes use lower doses, and many of the new trials that are looking at this drug are exploring some lower doses, 10 to 20 milligrams on a continuous basis, and it seems to have less of an adverse effect on the counts without giving up a whole lot on efficacy, at least based upon the single agent experiences so far.